and aside from the pain of a needle stick, there seemed to be no risk. But Hugh did not exempt those procedures. In fact, it later clarified the law to specifically include them. McCusick's research on the Lacks family coincided with the beginning of a new era of genetic research, in which the concept of risk to patients would change completely. With the ability to identify genes from a blood sample or even a single cell, the risk of a blood draw was no longer just a minor infection or the pain of a needle stick. It was that someone could uncover your genetic information. It was about violation of privacy. Deborah met McCusick only once, when she went into Hopkins to give blood. He shook her hand and said that Henrietta had made an important contribution to science. Then Deborah bombarded him with questions. What made her mother sick? How was part of her still living? What did that mean? What did Henrietta do for science? And did all those blood tests he was doing mean Deborah was going to die young like her mother? McCusick did not explain why he was having someone draw blood from Deborah. Instead, he told her about Henrietta's cells being used for the polio vaccine and genetic research. He said they'd gone up in early space missions and been used in atomic bomb testing. Deborah heard those things and imagined her mother on the moon and being blown up by bombs. She was terrified and couldn't stop wondering if the parts of her mother they were using in research could actually feel the things scientists were doing to them. When she asked McCusick to explain more about the cells, he gave her a book he'd edited called Medical Genetics, which would become one of the most important textbooks in the field. He said it would tell her everything she needed to know, then autographed the inside front cover. Beneath his signature, he wrote a phone number and told her to use it for making appointments to give more blood. McCusick flipped to the second page of the introduction. There, between graphs of disease-specific infant mortality and a description of the homozygous state of Garrodian inborn errors, was the photograph of Henrietta with her hands on her hips. He pointed to the paragraph that mentioned her. Parenthetically, medical geneticists making use of the study of cells in place of the whole patient have cashed in on a reservoir of morphologic, biochemical, and other information in cell biology derived in no small part from study of the famous cell line cultured from the patient pictured on this page, Henrietta Lacks. The book was filled with complicated sentences explaining Henrietta's cells by saying, "Its atypical histology may correlate with the unusually malignant behavior of the carcinoma, and something about the correlate of the tumor's singularity." Reading magazines took Deborah a long time, because she had to stop often to look words up in her dictionary. Now, she sat in the clinic, gripping McCusick's book, not even trying to read the words. All she could think was that she'd never seen that photograph of her mother before. What happened to her to make her end up in there? She wondered. And how did he get that picture? Day swore he'd never given it to McCusick or any of Henrietta's doctors. Deborah's brothers swore they hadn't either. The only thing Day could figure was that maybe Howard Jones had asked Henrietta for a picture, then stuck it in her medical record. But as far as Day knew, no one had ever asked permission to publish it. When I talked to McCusick several years before his death in 2008, he was 79 and still conducting research and training young scientists. He didn't recall where he'd gotten the photo, but he imagined Henrietta's family must have given it to Howard Jones or another doctor at Hopkins. Though McCusick remembered the research he conducted on the Lacks family, he didn't remember meeting Deborah or giving her his book, and said he'd never had first-hand contact with the family. He'd left that up to Hsu. When I talked to Susan Hsu, now a director of medical genetics at the American Red Cross, she told me that working with McCusick on HeLa cells was a highlight of her career. "I'm very proud," she told me. "I probably will Xerox these pages and tell my kids this is important." But when I explained to her that the Laxes thought she was testing them for cancer, and that they were upset about scientists using the cells without their knowledge, she was shocked. "I feel very bad," she said. "People should have told them. You know, we never thought at that time they did not understand." She also told me she had a message she hoped I'd give to the Lax family when I talked with them next. "Just tell them I'm really grateful," she said. "They should be very proud of the mother or the wife. I think that if they are angry, probably they didn't realize how famous the cells are now in the world. It's an unfortunate thing what happened. They still should be very proud. Their mother will never die as long as the medical science is around. She will always be such a famous thing." Toward the end of our conversation, Shu mentioned that she could learn much more from testing the family's blood today, since DNA technology had advanced so much since the 70s. Then she asked if I'd tell the Lax family one more thing for her. "If they are willing," she said, "I wouldn't mind to go back and get some more blood." Chapter 24. Least They Can Do, 1975. The Laxes didn't know anything about the HeLa contamination problem that led McCusick and Shu to them until Michael Rogers, a young reporter for Rolling Stone, showed up at their house with long hair and rock and roll clothes. Rogers was something of a journalism prodigy. By his 19th birthday, he'd gotten a degree in creative writing and physics and published his first story in Esquire. By his early 20s, when he started looking into the HeLa story, he'd already published 2 books and joined the staff of Rolling Stone. In coming years, he'd go on to be an editor at Newsweek and later The Washington Post. Rogers first learned about HeLa cells after seeing Helen Lane Lives, written over a urinal in a medical school bathroom. He started reading news reports about HeLa cells and the contamination problem and realized it would make a great story for Rolling Stone, the perfect mix of science and human interest. So Rogers set out to find this mysterious Helen Lane. He called Margaret Guy, who was friendly and talkative until Rogers asked about Helen Lane. Then she told him it wouldn't be a good idea for them to meet and hung up. Eventually, Rogers found his way to Walter Nelson Rees, who mentioned, as an aside, that Henrietta Lacks was the real name of the woman behind the cells. Soon, while sitting on his Baltimore hotel bed with the view of the Bromo Seltzer clock, Rogers found Lawrence Lacks in the phone book. It was the winter of 1975. The streets were icy, and on his way to Lawrence's house, Rogers's taxi was hit by another car in the middle of an intersection. The cab spun in the road, doing 5, then 6 full circles, as if some giant hand had reached down and spun it like a bottle. Rogers had done risky reporting all over the world. Now he was sitting in the back of a cab, gripping the door handle, thinking, "Damn it, it would be really stupid if I got killed in Baltimore working on this, of all assignments. It's not even a dangerous story." Decades later, as I talked with Rogers in his Brooklyn apartment, we agreed, only half-joking, that the spinning cab was probably no accident. Deborah would later say that it was Henrietta warning him to leave her family alone because he was about to tell them something upsetting. She'd also say that Henrietta started the famous Oakland, California fire that later burned Rogers's house, destroying all the notes and documents he'd collected about HeLa and Henrietta's family. When Rogers made it to Lawrence's house, he expected to interview the Laxes about Henrietta, but found himself bombarded with questions instead. "It was so clear they hadn't been treated well," Rogers told me. "They truly had no idea what was going on, and they really wanted to understand. But doctors just took blood samples without explaining anything and left the family worrying." Lawrence asked, "What I was wondering was, about these cells, they say they're stronger, they're taking over. Is that bad or good? Does that mean if we get sick, we'll live longer?" Rogers told the Laxes that no, the cells being immortal didn't mean they'd become immortal too, or that they'd die of cancer. But he wasn't sure they believed him. He explained the concept of cells as best he could, told them about the media reports that had already appeared about Gila, and promised he'd send them copies to read. At that point, no one in Henrietta's immediate family except Deborah seemed particularly upset about Henrietta's story or the existence of those cells.
"I didn't feel too much about the cells when I first found out they was living,"
Sonny told me years later.
"Long as it's helping somebody. That's what I thought."
But that changed when he and his brothers read Rogers's article and learned this. Cell lines are swapped, traded, forwarded, begged, and borrowed among research institutions around the world. The institutional sources of cells now range from government-supported facilities like Nelson Reese's to commercial outfits with toll-free 800 numbers, from whom one can order, for about $25, a tiny glass vial of Gila cells. With that paragraph, suddenly, the Lax brothers became very interested in the story of Gila. They also became convinced that George Guy and Johns Hopkins had stolen their mother's cells and made millions selling them. But in fact, Guy's history indicates that he wasn't particularly interested in science for profit. In the early 1940s, he'd turned down a request to create and run the first commercial cell culture lab. Patenting cell lines is standard today, but it was unheard of in the 50s. Regardless, it seems unlikely that Guy would have patented Gila. He didn't even patent the roller drum, which is still used today and could have made him a fortune. In the end, Guy made a comfortable salary from Hopkins, but he wasn't wealthy. He and Margaret lived in a modest home that he bought from a friend for a $1 down payment, then spent years fixing up and paying off. Margaret ran the Guy lab for more than a decade without pay. Sometimes she couldn't make their house payments or buy groceries because George had drained their account yet again buying lab equipment they couldn't afford. Eventually, she made him open a separate checking account for the lab and kept him away from their personal money as much as she could. On their 30th wedding anniversary, George gave Margaret a check for $100, along with a note scribbled on the back of an aluminum oxide wrapper. "Next 30 years, not as rough. Love, George." Margaret never cashed the check, and things never got much better. Various spokespeople for Johns Hopkins, including at least one past university president, have issued statements to me and other journalists over the years saying that Hopkins never made a cent off Gila cells, that George Guy gave them all away for free. There's no record of Hopkins and Guy accepting money for Gila cells, but many for-profit cell banks and biotech companies have. Microbiological Associates, which later became part of Invitrogen and BioWhitaker, two of the largest biotech companies in the world, got its start selling Gila. Since Microbiological Associates was privately owned and sold many other biological products, there's no way to know how much of its revenue came specifically from Gila. The same is true for many other companies. What we do know is that today, Invitrogen sells Gila products that cost anywhere from $100 to nearly $10,000 per vial. A search of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office database turns up more than 17,000 patents involving Gila cells. And there's no way to quantify the professional gain many scientists have achieved with the help of Gila. The American-type Culture Collection, a nonprofit whose funds go mainly toward maintaining and providing pure cultures for science, has been selling Gila since the 60s. When this book went to press, their price per vial was $256. The ATCC won't reveal how much money it brings in from Gila sales each year, but since Gila is one of the most popular cell lines in the world, that number is surely significant. Lawrence and Sonny knew none of this. All they knew was that Guy had grown their mother's cells at Hopkins. Somewhere, someone was making money off of them, and that someone wasn't related to Henrietta Lacks. So, in an attempt to get Hopkins to give them what they saw as their cut of the HELA profits, they made handouts about Henrietta Lacks's family being owed their due and gave them to customers at Lawrence's store. Deborah wanted nothing to do with fighting Hopkins. She was too busy raising her children and trying to teach herself about her mother's cells. She got herself some basic science textbooks, a good dictionary, and a journal she'd use to copy passage after passage from biology textbooks. "Cell is a minute portion of living substance," she wrote. "They create and renew all parts of the body." But mostly, she wrote diary entries about what was happening.
Going on with pain. We should know what's going on with her cells from all of them that have her cells. You might want to ask why so long with this news. Well, it's been out for years, in and out of videos, papers, books, magazines, radio, TV, all over the world. I was in shock. Ask and no one answers me. I was brought up to be quiet, no talking, just listen. I have something to talk about now. Henrietta Lacks, what went out of control. How my mother went through all that pain all by herself with those cold-hearted doctor. Oh, how my father said how they cooked her alive with radiation treatments. What went on in her mind in those short months? Not getting better and slipping away from her family? You see, I am trying to relive that day in my mind. Youngest baby in the hospital with TB, oldest daughter in another hospital, and three others at home, and husband got to, you hear me, got to work through it all to make sure he can feed his babies. And wife dying. Her in that cold-looking ward at John Hopkins Hospital, the side for blacks only, oh yes, I know. When that day came and my mother died, she was robbed of her cells, and John Hopkins Hospital learned of those cells and kept it to themselves and gave them to who they wanted and even changed the name to HeLa Cell and kept it from us for 20-plus years. They say donated? No, robbed self. My father have not signed any paper. I want them to show me proof. Where are they?
The more Deborah struggled to understand her mother's cells, the more HeLa research terrified her. When she saw a Newsweek article called People Plants that said scientists had crossed Henrietta Lacks's cells with tobacco cells, Deborah thought they'd created a human plant monster that was half her mother, half tobacco. When she found out scientists had been using HeLa cells to study viruses like AIDS and Ebola, Deborah imagined her mother eternally suffering the symptoms of each disease: bone-crushing pain, bleeding eyes, suffocation. And she was horrified by reports of a psychic healer who, while conducting research into whether spiritual healing could cure cancer, attempted to kill HeLa cells by a laying on of hands. He wrote, "As I held the flask, I concentrated on the picture I'd formed in my mind of the cells, visualizing a disturbance in the cell fields and the cells blowing up. While I worked, I could feel a virtual tug of war going on between my hands and the cells' powerful adhesive ability. Then I felt the field give way as I had broken through. The cells looked as though someone had put a tiny hand grenade into each one. The whole culture had just blown apart. The number of dead floating cells had increased 20 times. To Deborah, this sounded like a violent assault on her mother. But what bothered her most was the fact that so many scientists and journalists around the world continued to call her mother Helen Lane. "Since they'd gone ahead and taken her cells, and they've been so important for science," Deborah thought, "least they can do is give her credit for it." On March 25th, 1976, when Mike Rogers's Rolling Stone article hit newsstands, it was the first time anyone had told the true story of Henrietta Lacks and her family, The first time the mainstream media had reported that the woman behind Hila was black. The timing was explosive. News of the Tuskegee study was still fresh. The Black Panthers had been setting up free clinics for black people in local parks and protesting what they saw as a racist healthcare system. And the racial story behind Hila was impossible to ignore. Henrietta was a black woman born of slavery and sharecropping who fled north for prosperity, only to have her cells used as tools by white scientists without her consent. It was a story of white selling black, of black cultures contaminating white ones with a single cell in an era when a person with one drop of black blood had only recently gained the legal right to marry a white person. It was also the story of cells from an uncredited black woman becoming one of the most important tools in medicine. This was big news. Rogers's article caught the attention of several other journalists who contacted the Laxes. In the 3 months following Rogers's story, Jet, Ebony, Smithsonian, and various newspapers published articles about Henrietta, one of the pivotal figures in the crusade against cancer. Meanwhile, Victor McCusick and Susan Hsu had just published the results of their research in Science. In a table that took up about half of a page, under the headings Husband, Child 1, Child 2, H. Lax, and Hila, McCusick, Hsu, and several co-authors mapped 43 different genetic markers present in DNA from Day and two of the Lax children, and used those to create a map of Henrietta's DNA that scientists could use to help identify Hila cells in culture. Today, no scientist would dream of publishing a person's name with any of their genetic information, because we know how much can be deduced from DNA, including the risks of developing certain diseases. Publishing personal medical information like this could violate the 2006 Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, and result in fines up to $250,000 and up to 10 years in jail. It could also violate the 2008 Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, created to protect people from losing their health insurance or employment due to genetic discrimination. But there was no such federal oversight at the time. A lawyer might have told the Laxes they could sue on the grounds of privacy violation or lack of informed consent. But the Laxes didn't talk to a lawyer. They didn't even know anyone had done research on their DNA, let alone published it. Deborah was still waiting to hear the results of what she thought was her cancer test. And Sonny and Lawrence were still busy trying to figure out how to get money from Hopkins. They didn't know that on the other side of the country, a white man named John Moore was about to begin fighting the same battle. Unlike the Lax family, he knew who'd done what with his cells and how much money they'd made. He also had the means to hire a lawyer. Chapter 25. Who told you could sell my spleen? 1976 to 1988. In 1976, the same year Mike Rogers published his article in Rolling Stone and the Lax family found out people were buying and selling Henrietta's cells, John Moore was working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, as a surveyor on the Alaska pipeline. He thought the job was killing him. His gums bled, his belly swelled, bruises covered his body. It turned out that at the age of 31, Moore had hairy cell leukemia, a rare and deadly cancer that filled his spleen with malignant blood cells until it bulged like an overfilled inner tube. Moore's local doctor referred him to David Gold, a prominent cancer researcher at UCLA, who said that removing his spleen was the only way to go. Moore signed a consent form saying the hospital could dispose of any severed tissue or member by cremation, and Gold removed his spleen. A normal spleen weighs less than a pound. Moore's weighed 22. After the surgery, Moore moved to Seattle, became an oyster salesman, and went on with his life. But every few months between 1976 and 1983, he flew to Los Angeles for follow-up exams with Gold. At first, Moore didn't think much of the trips. But after years of flying from Seattle to L.A. so Gold could take bone marrow, blood, and semen, he started thinking, can't a doctor in Seattle do this? When Moore told Gold he wanted to start doing his follow-ups closer to home, Gold offered to pay for the plane tickets and put him up in style at the Beverly Wilshire. Moore thought that was odd, but he didn't get suspicious until one day in 1983, 7 years after his surgery, when a nurse handed him a new consent form that said, "I do not voluntarily grant to the University of California all rights I or my heirs may have in any cell line or any other potential product which might be developed from the blood and or bone marrow obtained from me." At first, Moore circled do. Years later, he told Discover magazine, "You don't want to rock the boat. You think maybe this guy will cut you off and you're going to die or something." But Moore suspected Gold wasn't being straight with him. So when the nurse gave him an identical form during his next visit, Moore asked Gold whether any of the follow-up work he was doing had commercial value. According to Moore, Gold said no. But Moore circled do not, just in case. After his appointment, Moore went to his parents' house nearby. When he got there, the phone was ringing. It was Gold, who'd already called twice since Moore left the hospital. He said Moore must have accidentally circled the wrong option on the consent form and asked him to come back and fix it. "I didn't feel comfortable confronting him," Moore told a journalist years later. "So I said, 'Gee, doctor, I don't know how I could have made that mistake. But I said I couldn't come back. I had to fly to Seattle.'" Soon, the same form appeared in Moore's mailbox at home with a sticker that said, "Circle I do." He didn't. A few weeks later, he got a letter from Gold telling him to stop being a pain and sign the form. That's when Moore sent the form to a lawyer, who found that Gold had devoted much of the 7 years since Moore's surgery to developing and marketing a cell line called Mo. Moore told another reporter, "It was very dehumanizing to be thought of as Mo, to be referred to as Mo in the medical records. Saw Mo today. All of a sudden, I was not the person Gold was putting his arm around. I was Mo. I was the cell line, like a piece of meat." Weeks before giving Moore the new consent form, after years of follow-up appointments, Gold had filed for a patent on Moore's cells and several extremely valuable proteins those cells produced. Gold hadn't yet sold the rights to the patent, but according to the lawsuit Moore eventually filed, Gold had entered into agreements with a biotech company that gave him stocks and financing worth more than $3.5 million to commercially develop and scientifically investigate the Mo cell line. At that point, its market value was estimated to be $3 billion. Nothing biological was considered patentable until a few years before Moore's lawsuit, in 1980, when the Supreme Court ruled on the case of Ananda Mohan Chakrabarty, a scientist working at General Electric, who'd created a bacterium genetically engineered to consume oil and help clean up oil spills. He filed for a patent, which was denied on the grounds that no living organism could be considered an invention. Chakrabarty's lawyers argued that since normal bacteria don't consume oil, Chakrabarty's bacteria weren't naturally occurring. They only existed because he'd altered them using human ingenuity. Chakrabarty's victory opened up the possibility of patenting other living things, including genetically modified animals and cell lines, which didn't occur naturally outside the body. And patenting cell lines didn't require informing or getting permission from the cell donors. Scientists are quick to point out that John Moore's cells were exceptional, and few cell lines are actually worth patenting. Moore's cells produced rare proteins that pharmaceutical companies could use to treat infections and cancer. They also carried a rare virus called HTLV, a distant cousin of the HIV virus, which researchers hoped to use to create a vaccine that could stop the AIDS epidemic. Because of this, drug companies were willing to pay enormous sums to work with his cells. Had Moore known this before Gold patented them, he could have approached the companies directly and worked out a deal to sell the cells himself. In the early 1970s, a man named Ted Slavin had done precisely that with antibodies from his blood. Slavin was born a hemophiliac in the 1950s when the only available treatment involved infusions of clotting factors from donor blood, which wasn't screened for diseases. Because of that, he'd been exposed to the hepatitis B virus again and again, though he didn't find out until decades later, when a blood test showed extremely high concentrations of hepatitis B antibodies in his blood. When the results of that blood test came back, Slavin's doctor, unlike Moore's, told him his body was producing something extremely valuable. Researchers around the world were working to develop a vaccine for hepatitis B, and doing so required a steady supply of antibodies like Slavin's, which pharmaceutical companies were willing to pay large sums for. This was convenient because Slavin needed money. He worked odd jobs, waiting tables and doing construction, but he'd eventually have another hemophilia attack and end up unemployed again. So Slavin contacted laboratories and pharmaceutical companies to ask if they wanted to buy his antibodies. They said yes in droves. Slavin started selling his serum for as much as $10 a milliliter, at up to 500 milliliters per order, to anyone who wanted it. But he wasn't just after money. He wanted someone to cure hepatitis B. So he wrote a letter to Nobel Prize-winning virologist Baruch Blumberg, who discovered the hepatitis B antigen and created the blood test that found Slavin's antibodies in the first place. Slavin offered Blumberg unlimited free use of his blood and tissues for his research, which began a years-long partnership. With the help of Slavin's serum, Blumberg eventually uncovered the link between hepatitis B and liver cancer and created the first hepatitis B vaccine, saving millions of lives. Slavin realized he probably wasn't the only patient with valuable blood, so he recruited other similarly endowed people and started a company, Essential Biologicals, which eventually merged with another larger biological product corporation. Slavin was only the first of many who have since turned their bodies into businesses, including nearly 2 million Americans who currently sell their blood plasma, many of them on a regular basis. Moore, however, couldn't sell the Mo cells, because that would have violated Gold's patent. So in 1984, Moore sued Gold and UCLA for deceiving him and using his body in research without consent. He also claimed property rights over his tissues and sued Gold for stealing them. With that, he became the first person to legally stake a claim to his own tissue and sue for profits and damages. When Judge Joseph Wapner, most famous for being the judge on the People's Court television show, ended up refereeing the depositions, Moore figured no one would take the case seriously. But scientists worldwide panicked. If tissue samples, including blood cells, became patients' property, researchers taking them without getting consent and property rights up front would risk being charged with theft. The press ran story after story quoting lawyers and scientists, saying that a victory for Moore would create chaos for researchers and sound the death knell to the university physician scientist. They called it a threat to the sharing of tissue for research purposes, and worried that patients would block the progress of science by holding out for excessive profits, even with cells that weren't worth millions, like Moore's. but plenty of science was already on hold while researchers, universities, and biotech companies sued one another over ownership of various cell lines. Only two of those cases mentioned the people those cells came from. The first, in 1976, involved ownership of an important human fetal cell line. Leonard Hayflick, the researcher who'd originally grown the cells, argued that there were numerous parties with legitimate property interests in any cultured cells, including the scientist who grew them, the financiers of any related work, and the donors of the original samples. Without any one of those contributions, he said, the cultured cells wouldn't exist, and neither would any money resulting from their sale. That case set no precedent, because it settled out of court, with rights to the cells being divided between the parties involved in the lawsuit, which didn't include the cell donor. The same was true of another case soon after, in which a young scientist took a cell line he'd helped develop in the United States and fled with it to his native Japan, claiming ownership because the original cells had come from his mother. The public didn't realize there was big money in cell lines until news of the Moore case hit, and headlines nationwide said things like, "Ownership of cells raises sticky issues. Who should have rights to a patient's cells? Who told you you could sell my spleen?" Scientists, lawyers, ethicists, and policymakers debated the issues. Some called for legislation that would make it illegal for doctors to take patient cells or commercialize them without consent and the disclosure of potential profits. Others argued that doing so would create a logistical nightmare that would put an end to medical progress. Ultimately, the judge threw Moore's suit out of court, saying he had no case. Ironically, in his decision, the judge cited the HeLa cell line as a precedent for what happened with the Mo cell line. The fact that no one had sued over the growth or ownership of the HeLa cell line, he said, illustrated that patients didn't mind when doctors took their cells and turned them into commercial products. The judge believed Moore was unusual in his objections, but in fact, he was simply the first to realize there was something potentially objectionable going on. Moore appealed. And in 1988, the California Court of Appeals ruled in his favor, pointing to the Protection of Human Subjects in Medical Experimentation Act, a 1978 California statute requiring that research on humans respect the right of individuals to determine what is done to their own bodies. The judges wrote, "A patient must have the ultimate power to control what becomes of his or her tissues. To hold otherwise would open the door to a massive invasion of human privacy and dignity in the name of medical progress." But Gold appealed and won. And with each new decision in the suit, headlines flip-flopped. Court rules cells are the patient's property. Court backs doctors' rights to use patient tissues. Nearly 7 years after Moore originally filed suit, the Supreme Court of California ruled against him in what became the definitive statement on this issue. When tissues are removed from your body, with or without your consent, any claim you might have had to owning them vanishes. When you leave tissues in a doctor's office or a lab, you abandon them as waste. And anyone can take your garbage and sell it. Since Moore had abandoned his cells, they were no longer a product of his body, the ruling said. They had been transformed into an invention and were now the product of Gold's human ingenuity and inventive effort. Moore wasn't awarded any of the profits, but the judge did agree with him on two counts: lack of informed consent, because Gold hadn't disclosed his financial interests, and breach of fiduciary duty, meaning Gold had taken advantage of his position as doctor and violated patient trust. The court said researchers should disclose financial interests in patient tissues, though no law required it. It also pointed out the lack of regulation and patient protections in tissue research, and called on legislators to remedy the situation. but it said that ruling in Moore's favor might destroy the economic incentive to conduct important medical research, and that giving patients property rights in their tissues might hinder research by restricting access to the necessary raw materials, creating a field where, with every cell sample, a researcher purchases a ticket in a litigation lottery. Scientists were triumphant, even smug. The dean of the Stanford University School of Medicine told a reporter that as long as researchers disclosed their financial interests, patients shouldn't object to the use of their tissues. "If you did," he said, "I guess you could sit there with your ruptured appendix and negotiate." Despite the widespread media coverage of the Moore suit, the Lacks family had no idea any of this was happening. As the debate over ownership of human tissues played out around the country, the Lacks brothers continued to tell anyone who'd listen that Johns Hopkins had stolen their mother's cells and owed them millions of dollars. And Deborah started handing out newsletters about her mother and the cells, saying, "I just want y'all to read what's on this paper, and tell everybody, bring it around. We want everybody in the world to know about my mother." Chapter 26, Breach of Privacy, 1980 to 1985. Despite her fears, Deborah didn't die on her 30th birthday. She just kept raising her kids, working various jobs as a barber, notary public, chemical mixer at a cement plant, grocery store clerk, limousine driver. In 1980, 4 years after divorcing Cheetah, Deborah took her car to a mechanic named James Pullum, who also worked at a local steel mill. They married in 1981, when Deborah was 31 and Pullum was 46, soon after he got called by the Lord to moonlight as a preacher. Pullum had some run-ins with the law before he was saved, but with him, Deborah felt safe. He rode around Baltimore on his Harley with a knife in his pocket, and always had a pistol close. When he asked Deborah why he'd never met her mother, she laid the Rolling Stone article on the bed for him to read, and he said she should get a lawyer. She told him to mind his own business. Eventually, they opened up a little storefront church, and for a while, Deborah stopped worrying so much about her mother's cells. Zakaria was out of prison after serving only 7 of his 15-year sentence. He'd gotten himself certified to fix air conditioners and work on trucks. But he still wrestled with anger and drinking, and on the rare occasions when he found jobs, he lost them quickly. He couldn't afford rent, so he slept most nights on a bench on Federal Hill in downtown Baltimore, or on the steps of a church across the street from his father's house. Day would sometimes look out his bedroom window and see his son lying on the concrete. But when he invited him in, Zakaria snarled and said the ground was better. Zakaria blamed his father for Henrietta's death, hated him for burying her in an unmarked grave, and never forgave him for leaving the children with Ethel. Day eventually stopped inviting him in, even though it sometimes meant walking past Zakaria sleeping on the sidewalk. At some point, Zakaria noticed an ad seeking volunteers for medical studies at Hopkins, and he realized he could become a research subject in exchange for a little money, a few meals, sometimes even a bed to sleep on. When he needed to buy eyeglasses, he let researchers infect him with malaria to study a new drug. He volunteered for research on alcoholism to pay for a new job training program, then signed up for an AIDS study that would have let him sleep in a bed for nearly a week. He quit when the researchers started talking about injections, because he thought they'd infect him with AIDS. None of the doctors knew they were doing research on Henrietta Lacks's son, because he'd changed his name. Zakaria and Deborah always figured that if Hopkins had found out he was a Lacks, they wouldn't have let him leave. The biggest payday any of the Lacks children ever saw came when Day and other workers got a settlement from a class-action lawsuit against a boiler manufacturer over the damage done to their lungs from asbestos exposure at Bethlehem Steel. Day got a check for $12,000 and gave $2,000 to each of his children. Deborah used hers to buy a small piece of land in Clover so she could someday move down to the country and live near her mother's grave. Sonny's rough period was only getting worse. Most of his income now came from a food stamp ring he ran out of Lawrence's convenience store. And soon he found himself in jail for narcotics trafficking. And it looked like Deborah's son Alfred was taking the same path as his uncles. By the age of 18, he'd already been arrested several times for minor offenses, like breaking and entering. After bailing him out a few times, Deborah started leaving him in jail to teach him a lesson, saying, "You just stay there till your bail comes down to where you can afford it." Later, when he joined the Marines and quickly went AWOL, Deborah tracked him down and made him turn himself in to the military police. She hoped some time in minimum security would convince him he never wanted to end up in a penitentiary. But things just got worse, with Alfred stealing and coming home on drugs. And eventually, Deborah realized she couldn't do a thing about it. She told him, "The devil got you, boy. That stuff you're on make you crazy. I don't know you, and I don't want you around here no more." In the midst of all this, someone told Deborah that as Henrietta's next of kin, she could request a copy of her mother's records from Hopkins to learn about her death. But Deborah didn't do it, because she was afraid of what she might find and how it might affect her. Then, in 1985, a university press published a book by Michael Gold, a reporter from Science 85 magazine, about Walter Nelson Reese's campaign to stop HeLa contamination. It was called A Conspiracy of Cells, One Woman's Immortal Legacy and the Medical Scandal It Caused. No one in the Lax family remembers how they learned about Gold's book. But when Deborah got a copy, she flipped through it as fast as she could, looking for her mother. She found the photo of Henrietta, hands on hips, at the front of the book, and her name at the end of the first chapter. Then, she read the passage out loud to herself, shaking with excitement. They were all the cells of an American who in her entire life had probably not been more than a few miles from her home in Baltimore, Maryland. Her name was Henrietta Lax. In the 10-page chapter that followed, Gold quoted extensively from her medical records, the blood spotting her underwear, the syphilis, her rapid decline. No one in Henrietta's family had ever seen those medical records, let alone given anyone at Hopkins permission to release them to a journalist for publication in a book the whole world could read. Then, without warning, Deborah turned the pages of Gold's book and stumbled on the details of her mother's demise. Excruciating pain, fever, and vomiting. Poisons building in her blood. A doctor writing, "Discontinue all medication and treatments except analgesics." And the wreckage of Henrietta's body during the autopsy. The dead woman's arms had been pulled up and back so that the pathologist could get at her chest. The body had been split down the middle and opened wide. Grayish-white tumor globules filled the corpse. It looked as if the inside of the body was studded with pearls. Strings of them ran over the surfaces of the liver, diaphragm, intestines, appendix, rectum, and heart. Thick clusters were heaped on top of the ovaries and fallopian tubes. The bladder area was the worst, covered by a solid mass of cancerous tissue. After reading that passage, Deborah fell apart. She spent days and nights crying, imagining the pain Henrietta must have been in. She couldn't close her eyes without seeing her mother's body split in half, arms askew, and filled with tumors. She stopped sleeping. And soon, she was as angry at Hopkins as her brothers. She stayed up nights wondering, "Who gave my mother medical records to a reporter?" Lawrence and Zakaria thought Michael Gold must have been related to George Guy or some other doctor at Hopkins. How else could he have gotten their mother's records? When I called Michael Gold years later, he didn't remember who'd given him the records. He said he'd had good long conversations with Victor McCusick and Howard Jones, and was pretty sure Jones had given him the photo of Henrietta. But he wasn't sure about the records. "They were in somebody's desk drawer," he told me. "I don't remember if it was Victor McCusick or Howard Jones." When I talked to Jones, he had no memory of Gold or his book, and denied that either he or McCusick ever gave Henrietta's medical records to anyone. It wasn't illegal for a journalist to publish medical information given to him by a source, but doing so without contacting the subject's family to ask additional questions, verify information, and let them know such private information was being published could certainly have been considered questionable judgment. When I asked Gold whether he tried to speak to the Lax family, he said, "I think I wrote some letters and made some calls, but the addresses and phone numbers never seemed to be current. And to be honest, the family wasn't really my focus. I just thought they might make some interesting color for the scientific story." Regardless, it was not standard practice for a doctor to hand a patient's medical records over to a reporter. Patient confidentiality has been an ethical tenet for centuries, the Hippocratic Oath, which most doctors take when graduating from medical school, says that being a physician requires the promise of confidentiality, because without it, patients would never disclose the deeply personal information needed to make medical diagnoses. But like the Nuremberg Code and the American Medical Association Code of Ethics, which clearly said that doctors should keep patient information confidential, the Hippocratic Oath wasn't law. Today, publishing medical records without permission could violate federal law. But in the early 80s, when someone gave Henrietta's medical records to Gold, there was no such law. Many states, more than 30 in fact, had passed laws protecting the confidentiality of a patient's medical records, but Maryland was not one of them. Several patients had successfully sued their doctors for privacy violations, including one whose medical records were released without her consent, and others whose doctors either published photographs or showed videos of them publicly, all without consent. But those patients had one thing going for them that Henrietta didn't. They were alive, and the dead have no right to privacy, even if part of them is still alive. Chapter 27. The Secret of Immortality, 1984 to 1995. More than 30 years after Henrietta's death, research on HeLa cells finally helped uncover how her cancer started and why her cells never died. In 1984, a German virologist named Harald Zurhausen discovered a new strain of a sexually transmitted virus called human papillomavirus 18, HPV 18. He believed it and HPV 16, which he'd discovered a year earlier, caused cervical cancer. HeLa cells in his lab tested positive for the HPV 18 strain. But Zurhausen requested a sample of Henrietta's original biopsy from Hopkins so he could be sure her cells hadn't been contaminated with the virus in culture. The sample didn't just test positive. It showed that Henrietta had been infected with multiple copies of HPV 18, which turned out to be one of the most virulent strains of the virus. There are more than 100 strains of HPV in existence, 13 of which cause cervical, anal, oral, and penile cancer. Today, around 90% of all sexually active adults become infected with at least one strain during their lifetimes. Throughout the 80s, using HeLa and other cells, scientists studied HPV infection and how it causes cancer. They learned that HPV inserts its DNA into the DNA of the host cell, where it produces proteins that lead to cancer. They also found that when they blocked the HPV DNA, cervical cancer cells stopped being cancerous. These discoveries would help lead to an HPV vaccine and eventually earn Zurhausen a Nobel Prize. Research into HPV eventually uncovered how Henrietta's cancer started. HPV inserted its DNA into the long arm of her 11th chromosome and essentially turned off her P53 tumor suppressor gene. What scientists still haven't figured out is why this produced such monstrously virulent cells both in and out of Henrietta's body, especially since cervical cancer cells are some of the hardest of all cells to culture. When I talked to Howard Jones 50 years after he found the tumor on Henrietta's cervix, he was in his early 90s and had seen thousands of cervical cancer cases. But when I asked if he remembered Henrietta, he laughed. "I could never forget that tumor," he said, "because it was unlike anything I've ever seen." I talked to many scientists about HeLa, and none could explain why Henrietta's cells grew so powerfully when many others didn't even survive. Today it's possible for scientists to immortalize cells by exposing them to various viruses or chemicals, but very few cells have become immortal on their own, as Henrietta's did. Members of Henrietta's family have their own theories about why her cells grew so powerfully. Henrietta's sister Gladys never forgave her for moving to Baltimore and leaving their father behind for Gladys to care for as he aged. The way Gladys saw it, that cancer was the Lord's way of punishing Henrietta for leaving home. Gladys's son Gary believed all disease was the wrath of the Lord, punishment for Adam eating the apple from Eve. Cootie said it was the disease-causing spirits. And Henrietta's cousin Sadie never knew what to think. "Oh, Lord," she told me once. When I heard about them cells, I thought, could it have been something live got up in her? You know, it scared me, 'cause we used to go around together all the time. Henny and I ain't never been in that nasty water down there in Turner's Station like the other peoples. We didn't go to no beach or nothing like that. And we didn't never go without no panties or anything. So I don't know how something got up inside Henny. But it did. Something came alive up in her. She died, and it just keep on living. Made me start thinking things, you know? Like maybe something come out of space, dropped down, and she walked over it. Sadie laughed when she said this because she knew it sounded crazy. But that did went through my mind, she said. I ain't lying. Everything just go through your mind, you know? How else you gonna explain them cells growing like they do? Every decade has had its landmark moments in HeLa research, and the connection between HPV and cervical cancer was only one of several in the 80s. At the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, a group of researchers, including a molecular biologist named Richard Axel, who would go on to win a Nobel Prize, infected HeLa cells with HIV. Normally, HIV can infect only blood cells, but Axel had inserted a specific DNA sequence from a blood cell into HeLa cells, which made it possible for HIV to infect them as well. This allowed scientists to determine what was required for HIV to infect a cell, an important step toward understanding the virus and potentially stopping it. Axel's research caught the attention of Jeremy Rifkin, an author and activist who was deeply involved in a growing public debate over whether scientists should alter DNA. Rifkin and many others believed that any manipulation of DNA, even in a controlled laboratory setting, was dangerous because it might lead to genetic mutations and make it possible to engineer designer babies. Since there were no laws limiting genetic engineering, Rifkin regularly sued to stop it, using any existing laws that might apply. In 1987, he filed a lawsuit in federal court to halt Axel's research on the grounds that it violated the 1975 National Environmental Policy Act because it had never been proven environmentally safe. It was widely known, Rifkin pointed out, that HeLa was an extraordinarily virulent and infectious line of cells that could contaminate other cultures. Once Axel infected HeLa cells with HIV, Rifkin said, they could infect other cells and expose lab researchers around the world to HIV, thus increasing the virus's host range and potentially leading to the future hazardous dissemination of the AIDS virus genome. Axel responded to the suit by explaining that cells couldn't grow outside of tissue culture, and that there was a world of difference between culture contamination and HIV infection. Science reported on the lawsuit, writing, "Even Rifkin admits that taken together, these events sound more like the plot of a grade B horror movie than the normal run of affairs in the country's biomedical research laboratories." Eventually, the suit was dismissed. Axel went on using HeLa for HIV research, and Rifkin's horror film scenario didn't come true. But in the meantime, two scientists had developed a theory about HeLa that sounded far more like science fiction than anything Rifkin had come up with. HeLa, they said, was no longer human. Cells change while growing in culture, just as they change in a human body. They're exposed to chemicals, sunlight, and different environments, all of which can cause DNA changes. Then they pass those changes on to each new generation of cells through cell division, a random process that produces even more changes. Like humans, they evolve. All of this happened to Henrietta's cells once they were placed in culture. And they pass those changes on to their daughter cells, creating new families of HeLa cells that differed from one another in the same way that second, third, and fourth cousins differ, though they share a common ancestor. By the early 90s, the little sample of Henrietta's cervix that Mary had put into culture in the Guy lab had given rise to many tons of other cells, all still known as HeLa, but all slightly different from one another and from Henrietta. Because of this, Lee Van Valen, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago, wrote, "We here propose, in all seriousness, that HeLa cells have become a separate species." Van Valen explained this idea years later, saying, "HeLa cells are evolving separately from humans, and having a separate evolution is really what a species is all about." Since the species name, HeLa, was already taken by a type of crab, the researchers proposed that the new HeLa cell species should be called Helacytin gartleri, which combined HeLa with cytin, which is Greek for cell, and gartleri in honor of Stanley Gartler, who dropped the HeLa bomb 25 years earlier. No one challenged this idea, but no one acted on it either. So Henrietta's cells remained classified as human. But even today, some scientists argue that it's factually incorrect to say that HeLa cells are related to Henrietta, since their DNA is no longer genetically identical to hers. Robert Stevenson, one of the researchers who devoted much of his career to straightening out the HeLa contamination mess, laughed when he heard that argument. "It's just ridiculous," he told me. "Scientists don't like to think of HeLa cells as being little bits of Henrietta because it's much easier to do science when you disassociate your materials from the people they come from. But if you could get a sample from Henrietta's body today and do DNA fingerprinting on it, her DNA would match the DNA in HeLa cells." Around the time Van Valen suggested HeLa was no longer human, researchers began exploring whether Henrietta's cells might hold the key to human life extension, perhaps even immortality, and headlines once again claimed that scientists had found the fountain of youth. In the early 1900s, Carrel's chicken heart cells supposedly proved that all cells had the potential for immortality. But normal human cells, either in culture or in the human body, can't grow indefinitely like cancer cells. They divide only a finite number of times, then stop growing and begin to die. The number of times they can divide is a specific number called the Hayflick limit, after Leonard Hayflick, who'd published a paper in 1961 showing that normal cells reach their limit when they've doubled about 50 times. After years of disbelief and argument from other scientists, Hayflick's paper on cell limits became one of the most widely cited in his field. It was an epiphany. Scientists had been trying for decades to grow immortal cell lines using normal cells instead of malignant ones, but it had never worked. They thought their technique was the problem, when in fact, it was simply that the lifespan of normal cells was pre-programmed. Only cells that had been transformed by a virus or a genetic mutation had the potential to become immortal. Scientists knew from studying HeLa that cancer cells could divide indefinitely, and they'd speculated for years about whether cancer was caused by an error in the mechanism that made cells die when they reached their Hayflick limit. They also knew that there was a string of DNA at the end of each chromosome called a telomere, which shortened a tiny bit each time a cell divided, like time ticking off a clock. As normal cells go through life, their telomeres shorten with each division until they're almost gone. Then they stop dividing and begin to die. This process correlates with the age of a person. The older we are, the shorter our telomeres, and the fewer times our cells have left to divide before they die. By the early 90s, a scientist at Yale had used HeLa to discover that human cancer cells contain an enzyme called telomerase that rebuilds their telomeres. The presence of telomerase meant cells could keep regenerating their telomeres indefinitely. This explained the mechanics of HeLa's immortality. Telomerase constantly rewound the ticking clock at the end of Henrietta's chromosomes so they never grew old and never died. It was this immortality and the strength with which Henrietta's cells grew that made it possible for HeLa to take over so many other cultures. They simply outlived and outgrew any other cells they encountered. Chapter 28. After London, 1996 to 1999. The story of Henrietta Lacks eventually caught the attention of a BBC producer in London named Adam Curtis, and in 1996 he began making the documentary about Henrietta that I would later watch in Courtney Speed's beauty parlor. When Curtis arrived in Baltimore with his assistants and cameras and microphones, Deborah thought everything would change, that she and the rest of the world